Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, Jason Williamson of the amazing band Sleaford Mods. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me. Or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is just by telling all your friends about it, letting everyone know that you know that you enjoy this podcast right here each and every time we put one up, which is about 2 a week now. We seem to be doing about 2 a week. You can also support the show by subscribing to it and rating it on your podcast platform of choice, or by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And thank you to all the people that do that over there at Patreon and support the show. And I can't thank you enough for doing that. It really helps us keep this thing going over here. And speaking of thanks, I got to give my thanks to the fine folks at Vans who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damien, do this show. Just don't lose money out at doing it. So just don't do it out of your own pocket anymore. And so they helped me cover the costs over here. And for that, I very much thank them because they just let me do what I want. I can book whoever I want to book. And they just helped me cover the costs of doing this thing for everyone. So thank you very much to Vans. And one day when that House of Vans comes back, oh my gosh. Oh, the first House of Vans that can come back after this thing. Holy, I am excited for that. All right. Oh, all right. But enough dreaming about the future. On to today's show. Today on the show, Jason Williamson from the band Sleaford Mods, a band that when they first came out, kind of set the world on its ear with a new sound that they were doing. They've been now around for a few years and keep finding new places to take it. Now, Jason's someone I've always wanted to have a prolonged sort of conversation with, or a longer conversation with. The only time I met him was briefly outside of the hotel at Primavera Sound years ago. And so now here we are, and we get to nerd out about this stuff. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore. This one's a short one, so I'm going to keep this short and sweet as well. Check out their brand new record, though, Spare Ribs, out on the legendary Rough Trade Records. And you can pick that up now, or listen to it now, or consume it however you consume music in 2021. There are many ways to consume music now, so consume as you will. Consume those Spare Ribs as you will. And while you're doing that, or before you do that, because I guess you can't really listen to that while you listen to this. Well, you could put that on low in the background, put this up higher, or, you know, you could. But it's better if you listen to this separately and then listen to that. Or listen to that and then whatever you decide to do. Anyway, here's Jason Williamson on Turned Out a Punk. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No problem at all. Nice to speak to you. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know, it's a weird time, as everyone keeps saying.
Yep.
So
yep.
We won't have to talk about that, I promise you. We're just going to talk about nerdy music shit. But I wanted to start this thing off the way they all start off, which is, Jason, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah, I was about 10. My stepbrother introduced me to his record collection, which was basically the Sex Pistols, with other assorted second wave punk bands like The Exploited, 999, Antipasti. So I was about 10, and I got into the Pistols, really, really heavily into the Pistols for a couple of years.
And what was it about that stuff that kind of drew you to it, especially the Pistols out of all those other bands?
At the time, that this was like 1980, so people still were quite shocked by the idea of the Sex Pistols. They were considered to be a very, just a really weird, inaccessible band, and completely repulsed by the working classes, even though they were a working class band, you know. Now they're associated with working class culture quite a lot, but back then they were considered to be quite aloof, quite posh, a bit arty. So yeah, you know, I mean, it was a real, they were a real powerful entity, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I guess around that time also, because of the British independent music charts, like weird punk bands, like I think The Exploited were even on Top of the Pops, but sure, like bands would pop up there, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it had its time, you know, definitely, without a doubt.
So where did you kind of go? You know, obviously you're very young at this point, uh-huh, like, but where did you kind of go from there music wise? Were you like into music prior to that? Or
I didn't go too far. When I got bang into the Jam, who were, yeah, you know, they came up around the same time. And they were part of the punk movement to a certain degree. But yeah, I got heavily into the Jam and all things mod orientated. And so went from the Jam into stuff like Tamla Motown, a bit of Northern Soul, and so forth.
What about bands like The Secret Affair? Because there was kind of like that sort of like second mod revival after the Jam kind of blew up, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they weren't, I wasn't really bothered at the time, but these days I think bands like Secret Affair, Merton Parker's sound actually better. Mm. you know, you know, time's been kind to them. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. No, 100%. Like those bands also, it's funny how just, you know, like certain stuff gets canonized and other stuff just kind of gets forgotten a little bit because, yes, those bands were popular.
Yeah, they were. People forget, you know, that, you know, these bands were riding high in the charts and, you know, making a fair bit of money from it. You know what I mean? But, mm-hmm, you know, things get buried very quickly. But yeah, that's an interesting point.
What about, like, because I know you're from around Nottingham, right?
Uh-huh.
What about this stuff like the Earache stuff and Napalm Death and all those bands that were kind of popping off around the same time?
No, never got into him. I know Mick Harris quite well. Mm-hmm. He used to drum for Napalm Death. I know him really well, actually. And I've done a couple of stuff for his side project, Scorn. But apart from that, no, I never got into it. But now, again, these bands just sound really interesting. You know, at the time I wasn't bothered. I was very one-dimensional mod. Nothing else really interested me, you know what I mean?
Well, it's funny too, because you had to like pick a side back then in a real way, because you only had so much money to buy music, so much money to buy clothes, where now it's like you can listen to everything. It's not like the same sort of tribal feel.
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah, really good point, actually, that. Really interesting. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, you were kind of sidelined by wanting to get into anything else purely because, you know, the selection was so few and far between because of finances. Yeah, I agree. Totally. Yeah.
So where did you kind of go as far as like local music wise? Were there local bands playing what was your first show that you went to or concert?
Public Enemy at Rock City in 1987 with LL Cool J and Eric B and Rakim.
What a show.
Yeah, so that was kind of like when Def Jam had sweeped, you know, America and obviously England with the Beastie Boys as well. Then it all kind of kicked off, didn't it? So yeah, I got heavily into Public Enemy, really. Well, LL Cool J initially, and then Eric B and Rakim with the Paid in Full album. And then I discovered Public Enemy, which were just nothing sounded like it. It was just really fucking just weird. Yeah, definitely, you know, I mean, that I got a ticket, went along to see that, and it was I'll never forget it. It was a real powerful gig.
Was it like how big is that venue? Was it like thousands of people, or is it still relatively small?
2,300. So yeah, when it gets packed, it gets packed. But that they came out on the stage. I bought Yo Bum Rush's show. You know, I liked it. It was interesting, weird. But when they came out on stage, it completely blew me away. It was unreal. To see them back in the day with the SW1s and the kind of air raid sirens going off. It's black punk, you know what I mean, really.
Absolutely. And I guess going back before that, when you were going to kind of more of the mod stuff, was it more going to like Northern Soul Nights, or like where were you kind of like communing with other people into that stuff?
Just in your bedroom generally, you know. I didn't really associate with any kind of events or scooter rallies. I went to a few times, but didn't really appeal to me. I was more into just the music and, you know, just trying to vibe off that, really.
And where were you buying records at this time?
Just around local record shops, in Grantham, where I was from, small town just outside of Nottingham. And, you know, when I was old enough, then it would be trips to London, trips to Nottingham, to access these record stores, you know, the bigger record stores.
And when did you start kind of playing music?
Oh, 21 years of age. I started singing in college bands, and just experimenting with the idea of being a singer. I started to learn guitar around 23, 24. It just went from there, really.
So I, you know, in researching and kind of reading up before this, I came across like you did stuff with Spiritualized at some point.
I did some stuff with two of the members, Tony and Kev, drummer and the guitarist. We were in a kind of doing a project, but that got sidelined as soon as they got the job with Spiritualized. I mean, back in the '90s, you know, Spiritualized were very much, they were kind of really a focused band, you know. They were quite a big band, so and still are, you know. Absolutely no disrespect to them, but they still are, yeah, completely. So yeah, obviously they went where the you know, the real experience was. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Well, they actually played a show here on top of the CN Tower, and at one point it was the highest concert ever held in the world.
Ooh! Wow! Wow!
And but then someone played a show on, you know, a mountain, and of course it destroyed that record, you know, shattered it. But so were you a fan of Spaceman 3 at all, or into that kind of stuff?
No, I wasn't bothered. You know, I was kind of very much meat and potatoes, and I went to a comprehensive, generally working class school where it was either the Jam or, you know, early U2, Spandau Ballet. You know, I found that rock and psychedelia, 70s rock, 60s R&B, psychedelia, all of the good stuff from that period generally was more celebrated at the local grammar school. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't until I met friends from that grammar school when I went to college to try and further my education that I started listening to bands like that. I hadn't listened to Led Zeppelin until I was 21, you know. So that kind of gives you an idea of how kind of cut off me and my friends were at school from it.
It's so funny how different, you know, like cultures are on different parts of this world, obviously. But like, just like, you know, Led Zeppelin is very much like working class, classic rock radio is what North American kind of like, you know, music, working class music is. But it's so different how I feel just in general, England and the UK feels like it's a lot more on trend or in a lot more kind of forward looking as in terms of music.
Yeah, I think to a certain degree, I think America trailblazes with hip hop completely. And so I think hip hop has taken over really everything and still remains to be the more poignant style of music that offers a fresher outlook in the sense of a musical creative, you know what I mean? But, you know, yeah, I suppose so. You know, there's little pockets of ideas going off in England that you know, you're not going to find in America. And so in that sense, yes, I agree. Yeah, to a certain degree anyway. You know, it's not, it used to be great, but we're not as great as we were, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So what was the vibe of the first sort of music project that you did?
It was kind of like indie, you know, wishy-washy guitar bullshit, and you know, not really my thing at all. So, but yeah, you know, it's I just love performing, and it was great to try and get doing some of that. You know what I mean?
Do you remember the first time you ever got on stage and performed?
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, absolutely terrible. Yeah, we were supporting a punk band, the local support band, and they just wiped the floor with us. You know what I mean? It was so dynamic and loud and you know, confident.
What was the band?
It was I forgot what they were called, but the guy comes on with a mask on and then just throws the mask in the audience and starts singing. I thought that was really good.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah
what about bands like the Voorhees and all that kind of stuff? Was that on your radar at all in the 90s, like that was happening, like you know, like kind of in Leeds and things like that? There was like a sort of a rise of a bit of a working class hardcore scene for a while.
No, not at all. Hardcore scene totally passed me by. All of it passed me by. You know, even the greats like, you know, I don't know, Black Flag, you know what I mean, etc. Completely passed me by.
Just in terms of your vocal sound, like it obviously, you know, it's something completely new and you're doing something really unique, but it falls in this tradition of sort of, you know, like punk poetry, almost like John Cooper Clarke and obviously Marquis Smith and people like that. Were those people on your radar at all? Or is your influence coming mainly from hip hop?
Yeah, just from hip hop. Yeah, they were. I was aware of these people, but they weren't. They didn't really say anything to me. It wasn't really something that I got into. You know, I got solely into rap and the mechanisms around rap and the idea of it, and then tried to apply myself to that. Do you know what I mean?
Do you remember the first time you ever heard rap?
Yeah. Well, obviously LL Cool J. You know what I mean? Bigger and Deffer. Before that, I don't know, there was a few bits and bobs, vague, I can't really remember, but I think that was where it really got me, you know what I mean?
So who were the sort of first UK rappers that were on your radar or that were happening, they're popping off around then?
Oh God, there wasn't any really. You had stuff like Derek B. What else? God, that was about it really. But you know, I didn't really rate him. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember Roots Manuva. I guess was
Roots Manuva. Oh God, they were like years later. But
yeah, years later, yeah.
Yeah, Roots Manuva definitely were. You know, he had a really good, strong voice.
I think he was also like the first guy that I can remember, you know, showing up here in sort of a big way, like big enough that it got on my very limited radar at the time.
He
I'm trying to remember, they had a track with Left Field that I think charted over here and kind of like, yeah, it felt like that was breaking through a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, at the time he was kind of an underground voice, but yeah, whenever you heard him, it was like, it was really something. He really married himself to the times, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I remember I lived in the UK for a year and Big Daddy magazine, and there was just like, you know, going to a lot of the record stores, it felt like it was like really kind of on the rise in sort of the mid 90s. Like that's when rap culture really kind of took hold in the UK. Am I misreading it? Is someone just
no,
visiting?
Completely, no, completely right. You know, it kind of really did, you know, but it wasn't until sort of the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s that it started morphing into something, something absolutely, you know, completely solid. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Who do you think was the artist that really broke through? Was it like the rise of grime or what was the
yeah, I think it was kind of like the people before that, stuff like So Solid Crew, and you know, to a certain degree The Streets, you know, kind of artists like that, that were hinting towards it, you know, dubstep, you know, MCs like gliding over those kind of things. I'm not a massive expert on it, but it was starting to pull up with those kind of things, definitely.
So I guess going back to, you know, your kind of journey in music, when did Unity Crescent come together and how did that band come together?
Oh, wow, bloody hell, you've been doing your own work, haven't you?
It's amazing how, like, obviously, you know, what you're doing now with Sleaford Mods is completely different, but at the same time, like, your voice is there in that project.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was starting to form more. Yeah, I was using more spoken word. I was sort of experimenting with more electronica outfits, and Unity Crescent was one of the ones that I was doing just before I discovered the formula for Sleaford Mods. Yeah, great. You know, I mean, it didn't last too long, but I definitely was getting an idea around that period. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of scene were you guys playing into, or were there like other bands that were kind of doing the same thing?
Not really. No. I kind of, you know, was a little bit influenced by The Streets and stuff like that, etc. A bit of Baxter Dury. No, at the time, no, there wasn't anyone around doing a similar thing within my vicinity anyway. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. So like what kind of artists and groups would you play with?
God, anything really, anybody that would put me on, you know what I mean? You know, towards the stage where just before I met Andrew, I was supporting a lot of noise artists in Nottingham. And I'd been kind of, you know, picked up by promoters within the noise scene because what I was doing was a little bit, you know, sort of avant-garde or whatever. I don't know. People thought he was a bit weird. So I kind of suited the kind of noise, you know, supporting noise artists and stuff. So yeah.
It's Nottingham's such an amazing city. Like, you know, we've obviously talked about the earache stuff that comes out of there, but there's like that huge noise scene. There's like a great punk hardcore scene out of there too.
I didn't know, actually. I mean, I was not aware of noise until they drafted me in with all these people. Like, what the fuck's this? What's this noise? But yeah, you know, I mean, it was a great time, really. It really spoke to me, you know, the energy of it, the originality of it as well, and the DIY nature of it, and just the kind of general fuck you attitude of it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we're going to do what we want to do. You know what I mean? Which I really, really liked.
Well, and that's something that definitely comes across in Sleaford Mods. Like, obviously when you started, there was probably no expectation of where it would go.
No, I just purely fell in love with the creative process of it, and I just thought that I found my own voice in it, and I was convinced it was going to go all the way, you know, initially, and then that soon changed. I had that beaten out of me, but I just kept going, you know, because it was the only thing I knew how to do that made me feel like I was expressing myself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like it. Going back to the kind of like the Nottingham kind of scene and all these different bands happening, it's amazing how many cool record stores there are. There used to be that really good, that great record store on the high street that had like a lot of rap records, had a lot of noise records too. And then there's that weird record store in an alleyway.
Yeah. I know
packed
what you mean.
Rafters.
Uh-huh. Selector Disc and Dave's Records. I think Dave's is still there. I'm not sure.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm glad that Dave survived.
It's Rob's Records, actually.
Rob's Records. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was Selector Disc. Yeah, both of them are gone, I think. Although I think Rob's is still. I'm not sure, actually. But yeah, they were great. You know, it was a great time for music in all aspects. I think now obviously the industry's changed completely, but you know, creativity finds a way, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I guess going back to when Sleaford Mods started, like how did you guys kind of come together?
I just met Andrew supporting a noise guy from Los Angeles, John something, I forgot his name now. You know, I was having a cigarette outside and there was this music playing. I was like, what is that? At the time, I was looking for something more original to work with because I was using samples. And so my antennae was out, so to speak. I went back upstairs and this guy behind the deck with his mate and I introduced myself, and that was Andrew. And I said, who's this? And he said, it's me. And he said, it's a remix of George Michael's Careless Whisper. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, well, do you want to get together? You know, and he was a little bit apprehensive at first, but yeah, we got it sorted.
And how long was that before that first CDR demo kind of comes out? The Mysterium?
I think it was about a year, probably a bit longer, probably okay. A year and a half. And we got the CDR out called Wank. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it kind of steamrolled after that, really.
Was it almost immediately after that came out that things started happening? Because like,
no, we got the attention of our old manager, Steve, who was part of the noise crowd, who were putting acts on and stuff. I think he heard me one night when it was the night actually I met Andrew, funnily enough. It was a couple of months later that he approached me and asked me if I wanted to release a record. And so, obviously, me and Andrew were over the moon about it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, that's where it came from, really. So,
was that the Wank demo, or is that the first 7-inch?
No, that was the album Wank, and that was something me and Andrew did on our own. But it was a bit confusing at first because I was going to do something with somebody else, and then that fell through, and so me and Andrew sort of got some new demos together, and Steve turned around and said, well, why don't you use tracks from Wank and these new tracks you got that you and Andrew have been working with and make a new album? And so that was Austerity Dogs, and that's how it went, really. You know, it was quite an incredible thing.
Yeah, it's a kind of like, was the British press on board right away? Because that's like obviously
no,
such
it,
a
it took a while.
Yeah.
It was I don't know, we had to go and tour in Europe first, you know what I mean? And when you know, we got a gig at a festival called the Crack Festival in Belgium. It was like a kind of expo for interesting acts around Europe. And so it would draw all the promoters, all the notable promoters from in and around Europe, the kind of DIY indie promoters. And we went down really well. And after that weekend, we got loads of bookings, tons of bookings. And so when Europe started to take notice, the UK press started to take notice, and we got a few gigs in London at more kind of notable venues, the old Blue Last, places like that. And that's when it started kicking off.
It's funny with the old Blue Last too. Like that's a venue that obviously, you know, it's gone now, right? They closed it down, I think. Pretty sure.
I don't know. Is it? I don't know actually. Yeah, I heard something like that, but I'm not sure.
But it's just amazing how many bands like kind of like played shows and kind of like that was like almost like a launching pad for a while in London.
Oh God, yeah. You know, we played there and it was like, because it was filling up as we were playing, it kept filling up, and it was sold out in the end. And you just felt like something was kicking off, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which as you can imagine was just brilliant. So.
Oh yeah. No, that's definitely, I remember playing there for the first time and that was like the moment where I'm like, this band thing might work. Like this could actually
something. Sure. So. Completely.
It's also wild how like, you know, different the music scene is there in London, like having talked to a lot of people, just how many managers are involved. Like it feels like it's like a real industry town and there's very few places that, you know, like a band that's just trying to do their thing can kind of play.
What, in London, do you mean?
Yeah, like I've just had so many artists from London on that talk about the fact that they had a manager, like, you know, when they were like, by the time they were 17 with their band, and like just how, you know, they're playing showcase shows and they're you know, playing label showcases and things like that. It just feels like it's a lot more of a music industry kind of town.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's kind of the hub of it. It mm-hmm. still remains so, you know. But obviously with the introduction of the internet, bands are, you know, you don't necessarily have to just go to London now. You can pretty much be discovered in a small town in Scotland, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If there's enough traction from whatever music you're releasing, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And there doesn't have to be a scene anymore, you know, like it's just like you can kind of just do your own thing and it could take off.
Yeah, I think kind of scenes are getting lesser and lesser, aren't they? You know.
Yeah.
Probably grime was the last notable one. I mean, there's talk of a post-punk scene in England, but I really don't see it, to be honest. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. You know, people like putting tags on things, but I don't really see it.
Well, like you're saying, it's almost like you can put a tag on something because it doesn't have to be geographically located. Like when you talked about the earache scene, it's like that was a very specific regional thing that was kind of kicking off. And yeah, like you can just kind of have a bunch of bands and be like, oh, this is a scene, but they're all over the place. They have no connection.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. You know, I think when we came out, there was us and there was Fat White Family and there was a couple of other bands that kind of kicked off a new kind of musical consciousness within indie, I guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're dead right. It doesn't have to all be in one place at one time. And they don't always have to have similar sounds, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's like, I don't know, like, well, that's what like punk was originally, right? Like the fact that you had John Cooper Clark and then you would have The Jam and you would have, you know, the Sex Pistols and they all kind of fall under the banner of punk.
Sure, definitely. There's just something about all of those things that aligns them. Obviously being there at the same time, same place, obviously being contemporary, fresh, a bit more edgier than what was on offer before, that all can contribute to being, you know, to all these very different bands being tagged together, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So how did the relationship with X Mist Records come about? Because that's a classic hardcore label.
Yeah, I mean, that again was for our old manager, Steve, who he knew all these people. So when we were releasing stuff, it was just a case. He just got his phone out and hooked us up with whoever to press a record so it would hit a certain part of Germany or a certain part of France or whatever, you know what I mean? So it really worked for those early stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And you guys have like such an extensive discography too, like so many singles and different EPs and stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Cassettes.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we're just kicking stuff out, properly kicking it out. And, you know, in hindsight, if it would have been better marketed, I think we'd have been a bigger band today. Do you know what I mean? But that's the way it goes, isn't it?
Yeah. Like it's weird how it works, you know, like it's almost like a lottery where you can kind of like step up there, but if it just doesn't break the right way, you know, the career goes a different path. Not that you guys aren't massively successful and been able to kind of like carve out, you know, like your own space in this world.
Sure. 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 Definitely. I think, but yeah, as you get on in the industry and you look at what becomes really big very quickly, for kicking out what is primarily middle of the road stuff, you just think to yourself, yeah, well, you know, if that proper insight had been there from the start, perhaps things could have been slightly different. But how different do you want them? You know, we're living a great life, you know what I mean? So you can't really complain.
Yeah, and also it's amazing how much, like, you know, once you get in the music industry and you find out the stories, you realize, like, how much of the stuff that you thought was organic was actually, like, weird machinations happening behind the scenes. And this band wasn't actually on this label. It was just, like, a deal so they could have indie cred before they signed right to the major type thing. Like, it's just...
Oh, so much of that cloak and dagger stuff, even now, you know. And it's like, even with bands that are, you know, that you can't really argue that aren't doing... that haven't got a great message, but you still think, yeah, there's still some showbiz going off there, you know. And I think showbiz is a part of it. You have to have a bit of that because that's unavoidable, you know. You have to have marketing. You've got to have some kind of PR, obviously. But you just, I just think sometimes directions are made in order to get bigger, simply just get bigger, which, you know, is I'm not necessarily sure sometimes that's the right thing. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, that's, you know, it's, you know, you choose your path, right? Like you're either like an artist that does whatever it takes to get as popular as possible, or you're yourself.
Sure. And I think, you know, a lot of these bands these days are having these like big collabs, lobbing it on there and still passing themselves off as integral, when, you know, these collabs are just like product placement and it's just going to shove their album into playlists. It's going to make it, it's going to give them a bigger audience, but at the expense, I think, of the quality of the music, you know what I mean? It's just not entertaining. It's not, it loses some of that sharpness, you know what I mean?
But this goes back too, right? Like, you know, you hear stories about Creation and Oasis, like, you know, you hear stories about like all these things where this is the music industry fuckery that will always exist.
Oh, God, yeah, fucking hell, big time, you know. I think, I don't know, with Oasis, they had a bit of a lifespan for a couple of years, and then, yeah, it wasn't happening after that. It just got a bit weird, just a bit, do you know, just a bit dinner time, didn't it? You know what I mean? So, but yeah, I hear you, definitely, you know. You get a lot of this shit all of the time, and yeah. I think, but it is still possible to resist a lot of that and still have a sizable presence. You know what I mean?
Well, I think you guys are a testament to that. Like, you know, yeah. Like, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on the phone with you. Like, I'll talk to people about this too, that like, you know, your band is proof that if you do what your sound is and you do it your own way, you can carve space and, you know, and accomplish it and make your band a thing.
Thank you. I mean, we'd like to think so. You know what I mean? It sometimes does your head in. Yeah. But most of the time it's really rewarding. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think any level of press, especially, you know, with like, you know, the UK music press and at the time, you know, now it's not the same thing as a few years ago, but like it is like an acquired brain injury after a while. Like, you know, it's just, it does your head in, as you said, like you end up double thinking yourself and triple thinking yourself because people are watching all the time.
Yeah. And there's no right or wrong. Either. Yeah. It's like people have too, you know, opinions are like arseholes. Everyone's got one, haven't they? So it doesn't matter if you played by the moral code book completely. Somebody's always going to have something negative to say about you, you know. So if you can ride that shit, you're laughing, I think.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, right? Like, it's as much as it's a lottery, it's also like a war of attrition. Like, can you survive long enough for people to go back and look back at your group and retroactively be like, okay, they were right.
Yeah, this is it. And I think you can. It's possible. It really is. You've just got to have your antennae set for it. And, you know, you've just got to be cool about it all of the time. And I know that's a bit of a cheesy word, but it's right. You've got to be cool with it. And, you know, so many people aren't. They're just like, this is bollocks. What are you talking about? You're kidding yourself. Shut up. You know what I mean? It's like, no, I'm seeing through this. Shut up.
Jason, this has been awesome. Anytime you want to come back on this podcast, the door is always open.
Oh, bless you. I'm sure I'd love to. You know, we'll get it together next year or something.
Thank you, Jason, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Jason will be back for a part two at some point in the future. But before that, check out their brand new album, Spare Ribs, in stores now on Rough Trade Records. And since we're talking about the future, coming up in a few short days on this podcast, in the future on this podcast, is Alison Braun, a.k.a. Mouse, a legendary photographer. If you do not know her by name, you certainly will know her by image that she has created. Some of the most iconic West Coast punk images are from her lens. And we will talk about that. We talk about, she's got amazing stories. This next episode with her is a doozy. It's a fun one. It's a fun one. Get excited. Get amped for that. And that is it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves. Go out there right now. Get informed. Show up for protests, demonstrations. Donate money if you can to causes. And just get involved. Smash fascism. Fuck that Nazi stuff. Disgusting. Also, go out there and make your own culture. It really does help. You know, you don't have to put it out there for the world, but, you know, go out there, make music, draw, do something. Just exercise that part of your mind. And it really does help with mental health stuff, too. And anyone can do this. Anyone can make a podcast. I got to make that How to Make a Podcast episode soon. I will. But it's so easy that I just keep struggling with, like, how to start it, because really there's some costs involved. Anyway, we'll get into it on that episode, but go out there and make your own culture in the meantime. A fanzine, you know, fanzines are the best medium in the world. I was looking through my fanzine collection today and a lot of work to make them, but even just planning to make a fanzine can be fun and creative. You know, I've definitely wasted countless periods of my life doing that with groups of people. So, sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. It's just literally dead weight at that point. So sign those cards and give someone else, a gift of life with that. And wear a mask. Wear a mask. Check in on your friends. And I will see you next episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Bye.